Hello and welcome to Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. Today's guest is Jim McKelvey. He's the co-founder of Square, the now public company he started with Jack Dorsey, who also started Twitter. In this conversation, we discuss the origin story of Square and the 14-part innovation stack that allowed them to win in this market, how they went up against major companies like Amazon and One, examples of innovation stacks from companies like Southwest Airlines and others, and he explains how they were able to reduce the price of their card reader from $1,000 to 97 cents. We also talk about the difference between invention and innovation, entrepreneurship versus owning a business, and why being a billionaire isn't all it's cracked up to be. Lastly, we're giving away some copies of Jim's book. You can join the email list to enter. Follow the link in the description below for more details. If you're new here, make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcast app. We've got new episodes every single Wednesday. You can also watch all of these interviews on youtube.com/CreatorLab FM. We'll get straight into this conversation after this short message from my partner. This episode is supported by InstaSleep Mint Melts, the drug-free, convenient sleep aid. They're easy to take without water and melt in your mouth like a mint. They're designed to help you fall asleep faster and wake up without feeling groggy in the morning. If you've had issues sleeping like I have, try them out. They're available at select Walgreens stores and at their website, upgradeyoursleep.com. Now let's get into the show. Jim, welcome to the show.
Bilal, thanks for having me on.
I've been really excited about this conversation, man. I mean, you're the co-founder of Square, what you're most famous for. You've also got a book that we're going to discuss today. But you've done so many other things in the past. So we're going to dig into a few of those things today, and then we're going to explain some of the concepts from your book as well. It would be great just to get a high level, you know, in like a minute or so, like, what is your background? How did you land into this world?
Oh, wow. I don't really have a clear trajectory here. I graduated with degrees in computer science and economics. After school, I became a professional glass blower without any training in art. I made a living as an artist. Then I started a tech company. Became a glass artist, started a roofing company, started a nonprofit, started Square. I've been bouncing all over the place. I don't have a career path.
Yeah. So tell me about glass blowing, because when I was looking up your background, that was really interesting to me, because it's not every day someone who's quite a serious business person in one world is doing stuff like glass blowing. I don't actually know that much about it. I saw a video of you on YouTube, but how did you get into that?
I'm not that much of a serious business person, to be honest, but the glass blowing was funny. I went to work for a startup straight out of school. And it was run by a guy who was basically a crook, and I didn't realize it at the time. And so when I did realize it, I went in and quit. And I wasn't smart enough to line up the next gig. So I had nothing to do the next morning. And I woke up, I was like, wait a second, how am I going to pay the rent? And I thought, well, maybe I can go into the glass studio, because I'd taken glass blowing as a senior in college and still had access to the school studio because I was a TA there. I thought, well, maybe I can make some work and sell it. And it turns out the answer was no, because my work was terrible. But it's amazing how fast you can get a skill if you need to live. And so I just woke up that morning and I was like, you better learn how to blow glass really well and sell your work or you're going to starve. So after about a month, I was selling my work. And after about 6 months, I was actually making a pretty good income. So that's how I became a glass blower.
On your about page on your website, you try to avoid turning everything into a Wikipedia page, because if someone wants to read your full history, they can go to that. But I would love to kind of set the scene a little bit, because you started Square with Jack Dorsey, who's obviously famous for founding Twitter. But you actually met him way before, and I didn't actually realize that until I dug into your story a little bit. Could you kind of give a background on like how you met Jack Dorsey for the first time as well?
I hired Jack when he was 15. His mother ran a coffee shop. And in the days before Ritalin was easily available, we used to use chocolate covered coffee beans to stay awake. And so we were buying from his mother, and his mom said, oh, I've got this son who likes computers. And we said, oh, you know, he should come by the office. So he came by the office one day. Turns out he came up on a day that we were having a real fire drill. And so I hired him on the spot. Never met him, basically said, you know, can you work a scanner? He said, yes. And we put him to work and he pulled an all nighter with us. Like he got in real trouble with his mom. Cause I think we sent him home at 5 a.m.
And he was 15 years old. That's crazy.
He was 15 year old. Yeah. Just made him pull an all nighter on his first day. So
a kid's allowed to work at 15.
That's the thing about a startup. Sometimes you don't check all the rules. You know, I it's probably legal. I don't know. McDonald's dug it. Does it? I don't know. Really don't know. Next question.
Not trying to get you in trouble here, man. But that's cool.
So the statute of limitations has run out on that. That was 25 years ago.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I remember hearing a story that, you know, he came in to do some sort of scanner work, you said, but you kind of just threw him at all sorts of different tasks, I think it was. So did you?
Yeah. So I noticed a pattern with Jack's behavior, which is that he was always willing to take on new tasks and he always did them really well. So what I started doing out of just a sense of curiosity and maybe greed is I started giving him bigger and bigger tasks. So over time he went from, you know, just sort of clerical work to writing programs. He designed the new company logo. He was doing a lot of stuff. And then eventually he and I started traveling together, going around selling the product. So he really got a full taste of business over the course of 2 years of employment. And this was while he was going to school. So he wasn't working for us full time in the summer and then, you know, here and there. But Jack and I really struck up a, you know, great relationship. I jokingly referred to him as Jack the Genius when he was 15. And, you know, we stayed in touch. And after they kicked him out of Twitter the first time, we decided we'd start a company.
If we fast forward to Square, I'd love to understand like what that initial idea was and the story behind why you started Square in the first place. I mean, was there a moment you noticed, okay, this is a real problem? Because most people looking from the outside would say this is something a small startup can't really address.
Yeah. So it was funny. And this is actually the reason I wrote the book partially was because I sort of stumbled onto this thing that really worked well. But, you know, Jack and I had reconnected and we wanted to start a company, but we didn't have any ideas. So like most founders, we went on a little brainstorming session and we, you know, we kind of thought mobile phones were going to be important. This was back in 08, 09. And it seemed clear that the iPhone was going to change the world. So we wanted to do something in that area. But we couldn't touch social networking because of Twitter. And so we were going to do something that was sort of a journaling app. It was one of Jack's ideas. And I wasn't that excited about it. I don't think he was either. But we were just going to do it to get started. And then I went back to my glass studio and was trying to pack up my stuff. And a lady called to order a piece of glass that had been sitting on the shelf for like 3 years. And it was this hideous thing that I'd made. And I couldn't sell it. And I was so excited because, you know, I kind of needed the money to move out to California and it was a big sale. But I lost the sale because I couldn't take an Amex card. All she had was Amex. And I was so pissed. Like after losing that sale and I looked down at my iPhone and I thought, you know, why does this iPhone not allow me to take a credit card payment? And so I called up Jack and I said, hey man, I think I know what we should be doing. We should be building a credit card system so that little merchants like me can't lose future sales. And Jack thought that was an interesting idea. So we decided to explore the world of payments, which we didn't know anything about it, but it was, you know, very fruitful. And it turns out that there's a pattern of, you know, discovery that happens when you do something that you're kind of not qualified to do. And that's what we did.
That's an interesting point. I guess that kind of is sometimes referred to as the kind of beginner's mind or fresh pair of eyes in a new industry, I guess I've heard other people talk about it. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's a beginner's mind. And it's funny, Bilal, because it's only appropriate in certain situations. And Jack and I sort of accidentally found ourselves in this situation. I now know how to identify it. So I now know when I'm in that situation and I don't. But at the time, we were just sort of bumbling around. And we really didn't understand the payments world. So we had this very naive view of what was possible. And it turns out that it was a lot harder than we thought, but it was also an advantage to not know how difficult the road was going to be.
Fast forward, you know, however many years it's been now, I guess 10 years or so. When you first started, it really started with this swipe of the card on your phone device, right?
Yeah, it was a very simple idea. The beginning of Square was very humble, and we didn't know if it was going to work because when you're building something that's never been built before, you don't have the security of knowing that there's a market ready to accept it. And that's one of the big differences between doing something that is traditionally entrepreneurial, and I guess we'll get into the traditional definition of entrepreneur in a minute, and something that is an established business. And we did not build an established business. In other words, we were not doing something that had already been done before. So we didn't know if there was a market or not.
How did you know to focus on this one particular idea? Was there, did you even have those other ideas initially? Or I'm just curious how you've worked out how to focus on one thing.
Well, I mean, I only know the ideas that I had. So I had some of the ideas. Jack had some of the ideas, but a lot of our ideas have come not from Jack's brain or my brain, but from our customers. And, you know, we've got 3,000 employees. So a lot of them have great ideas every day. So it's not really so much having the idea. It's having something, at least in my mind, that you can focus on. And in my case, I always try to focus on problems, not opportunities. I was a guy who got up in the morning and said, gee, I need to sell my stuff and I need to be able to take the payments that people want to use. In my case, they wanted to pay me with credit cards and I couldn't accept some of those credit cards. And so that was a real problem for me personally. And so that was the original Square product. It was just something that I wanted. I mean, it wasn't built really for the world. It was built for me first. And then once I looked at it and said, yeah, I could use this, then we decided to give it to a flower vendor who was literally selling flowers for cash in front of Jack's apartment. And she loved it.
That's cool. So I guess one thing I've heard you talk about is looking at underserved markets. And you've talked about almost any industry, there's underserved markets, I think is what I took from one of your conversations you've had in the past. So I guess if you look at the Square example, you're looking at the street vendor, someone selling a t-shirt outside or flowers, and they weren't able to take, you know, accept credit cards. Do you think that, did I understand that correctly? And do you think that's still the case that you can almost innovate in most industries if you just look at the underserved market?
I think so. I mean, you know, I don't want to give any formulas. So like if you buy my book looking for some, you know, like checklist to become a billionaire, it's not in there. But there is one thing that is sort of in there that I think is sort of formula-like, which is this pattern I saw with these multi-billion dollar world dominating companies. They didn't start by serving the elite. They began by serving the disenfranchised, the people who were not included. And that I found really powerful because if you look at it, I mean, there are just not too many elites in the world. I mean, and if you make some sort of a, you know, douchey product that only rich people want, well, good luck with that. But if you make a product that makes things possible to normal people, there are a lot of normal people. There are a lot of just simple folk, and I was one of them, and still am, frankly. And I'm, you know, always looking to be included more. So, for instance, if you look at the great fashion brands right now, a lot of them are affordable fashion for everyday people. You know, the big fortunes in retail are, you know, the Walmarts and the Amazons that get, you know, goods and services into the hands of people cheaply. Southwest Airlines, which is one of the companies that I studied big for the book, made air travel possible for, you know, probably 80% of America that at the time wasn't flying. So I'm a big believer in opportunity at the bottom of the market.
That's interesting, though, because I've heard, and I guess with anything like this, there's no one size fits all or black and white answer. And you could probably find examples on the other side too. But I've also heard from some people I've spoken to that when you're starting in a niche, sometimes starting at the higher end can be a positive thing because in terms of brand, when you make it cheaper, it maintains the brand. Like example, like a Tesla is one example probably of that, where they started with a higher end model and then moved down to cheaper models. And then Uber is the other one that I think of. When they first started, they tried to position it as, you know, a private car service, and then it became, you know, anyone almost with a smartphone can order a cheap taxi essentially. I mean, do you see any flaws in that logic?
No. You know, you can start at the high end if you're supplying a product and you need to get the company going, and you can get a sort of foothold. That's legit, and I have total respect for Uber and Tesla. In Square's case, we just went for the bottom. We just went for the lowest end of the market. Now, we could have gone for the upper end, but the problem with that is it gets very sticky. And I would argue that, you know, Tesla still hasn't quite gotten down to the point where their cars are affordable for normal people. Now, hopefully they're doing that. You know, I think Elon Musk is doing Tesla not just, you know, to make another $1 billion. It's probably to, you know, help the planet and help transportation and help people. And I think that's his motivation. But it's very sticky if you start getting some success to just stick with your elite clients. And they're going to want more features and more features and more features. They're not going to want a lower cost and more accessibility.
That makes sense. And when I was doing the research here, I the key insight I saw with Square was that small SMBs, or, you know, a guy down the street selling flowers, like you said, they were being charged 45 times more than a massive corporation in terms of what it costs them to receive or accept credit card payments. And
yes,
is that something that you guys had dug into before you started the business, or was it just something you happened to find later? Because my approach is really, you know, I try to find data points to support my logic where I can, and I'm sure a lot of business people do that. But I've heard you talk about a company like Square, you can't really predict the size of the market, right? It's something new. So you're not really able to look at a market study and say, okay, this is the area we're going to attack. I'm just curious, like, how you guys approach that.
So let's start by understanding that it's impossible to do a market study of a market that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And you know, the great example in my world was when Herb Kelleher, who was the founder of Southwest Airlines, told me that the government did a survey of the people who wanted to fly in airplanes and discovered, lo and behold, that only rich people and business people wanted to fly, right? Poor people don't want to fly. Poor people want to spend 14 hours on a Greyhound bus, you know, and that was the conclusion of the U.S. government. And that was because if you survey the flyers, well, the only people you see on the flights are the ones who can afford them, and they happen to be rich people or business people. So there's your study, right? Flat out wrong, but there's your data. So studying a market that doesn't exist is comically stupid. So then the question is, what's your data? And in our case, we didn't have much data when we started Square. Now, I happened to discover that number you just quoted on the first week, because we were building our product, and I'm not a very good programmer. So we had Jack, who's a good programmer, and then we hired our first employee, and he was a pretty good programmer. And then I was sort of the third guy and wasn't a good programmer. So I had to do everything else. So I was the one who had to figure out how the market worked and, you know, do all the hardware and stuff like that. And so the study that you just quoted was shocking to me, but I knew there was something wrong because I was a small business person and I knew I was getting ripped off. And you know, so it's one of those things, Bilal, when, like, you know, when you're getting taken advantage of, but you can't prove it, you know, how pissed off, like, you like, I know I'm getting ripped off here, but I really, you know, I can't do anything about it. But that's how I felt for years as a small merchant, you know, taking credit cards. And so I finally, once I started Square, had the luxury of sort of dedicating my time to investigating the crime scene. And that's what led me to that number, that it was really true. Small businesses pay 45 times as much as big businesses to process credit cards, at least in terms of the profit that's made on their activities. And I'll tell you, Square has taken that number down substantially from what it used to be.
That's cool. Yeah. So I know now Square powers like 25% of US transactions or something along those lines. So you guys have really clearly changed that whole market. And it sounds like, you know, people before Square, a lot of your customers weren't necessarily accepting credit cards. They were probably accepting cash, or is that just an assumption I'm making?
No, it's true. A lot of our growth came from people who were previously just accepting cash.
Got it. So yeah, this kind of brings up the topic of the unbanked, and I've heard you kind of touch on it a little bit before, and I don't know that much about it, but I do hear this term, the unbanked, quite a lot, especially when we're looking at a global context. But even within the US, and my understanding of it is there are some people who just don't have bank accounts, even today in 2020. So is that something you guys have obviously now looked at? But I'd love your kind of insight onto the current state of affairs, or where that world is kind of going, and who out there is trying to serve those people.
So it's a pretty big problem. There are two groups. There's the unbanked, and then there's the underbanked. And if you look at people who don't have access to proper financial support, you'll see there are tens, if not hundreds of millions of people in that category, and just in the United States. So the question is, what do these people need to do? And the answer is, you know, fairly simple at the beginning, which is you need a safe place to store your money. You need a way to send and receive money. So a great example was when the government was giving out this triple P money and the unemployment insurance proceeds, you know, for the pandemic. A lot of people who were the most severely hurt by the pandemic didn't have bank accounts, and they didn't have accounts with the IRS. And since the IRS was, the one supplying the file to the Treasury, a lot of these people couldn't get paid unless Square stepped in. And fortunately, we had the Cash App, which got literally millions of people. I can't tell you exactly how many, because I don't think I'm allowed to say that number, but it was in the millions who were able to get paid as a result of this tool that we built. And if we hadn't built that tool, you know, these people who really needed that support probably couldn't have gotten it. And so you see these problems all the time. And, you know, I don't want to talk about immigration. I don't want to get in any sort of, you know, political controversy here, but I'll just say this, you know, there are a lot of good, hardworking people who you think of as, you know, essential to the country, who are just not connected to the world of finance. And it's damaging. Like if you you look at some of these people, what they have to do. So, I mean, you talked about me having a roofing company. That was a disaster, by the way. I was a terrible roofer. But I remember having to pay all my guys in cash, because a lot of my workers didn't have bank accounts. So I would have to go out on Thursday and pull, you know, these, you know, thousands of dollars of cash to pay the team. And then I'm paying the team in cash. And then, you know, these guys get robbed because they carry all this cash and everybody knows that they got cash. And it's just a massive mess. Somebody needed to fix that.
Yeah, man, it's crazy. And I was actually just traveling in Argentina for a few months last year. And a friend of mine, or someone, a listener of the show, Marcus, he just started a new job where he's working closely with Brazil. And he said in Brazil, a lot of people don't have banks and a lot of people don't use credit cards at all. And in Argentina, it was crazy because I met people there who literally carry cash, and they put cash underneath their mattress, literally. Like, you know, it sounds like an old cliche, but people don't trust having stuff in a banking system there. So I'm curious how you think about that evolving. Like, it still seems like a huge issue. And I guess you guys have come up with a solution for that in the US with the Cash App. But is this something that globally could be used, or what else is needed for people to have access to the basic banking services?
So, you know, I'm much more comfortable speaking as a US citizen about the US situation. And there are a lot of underbanked and unbanked in the United States that the Cash App is serving well. And also a lot of normal people. Like, I use Cash App all the time to, you know, pay people and send money and trade stocks. I mean, it's a fantastic app. One of the things globally is you have to be very, very respectful of the fact that different countries have different needs and different rules and laws. And you can't just walk into a country and start moving money around. That'll get you in trouble pretty quickly. Now, obviously the cryptocurrencies are somewhat of an exception to that, and we could talk crypto all afternoon, but generally my attitude is to be deeply respectful of the local situation. And so, I remember like 4 years ago, I think when India demonetized, I don't know if you remember that, the government just all of a sudden said, you know, the biggest banknotes are no longer valid forms of savings. And you had people who had literally their entire savings in these, you know, sort of large banknotes, probably under mattresses, that, you know, quickly had to run in and exchange those for lower notes or try to get some sort of bank account. It was a disaster. A lot of people got hurt. Now, they also caught a bunch of criminals. They caught a bunch of people who were, you know, paying cash and avoiding taxes. So that was kind of good, but they were really disruptive to society. And you just can't go in and apply one solution, you know, worldwide.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So I guess, so before we get completely sidetracked from the Square story, I guess one key part of the story is like inventing that initial product. And we've talked about why you focused on that already. But just take me back to that moment. What were you guys thinking of? Okay, we need someone to be able to accept a credit card on their phone. Like, how do you even begin with something like that?
So it was very simple. I just looked at myself and the needs that I had. And so Jack and I sat down and said, well, what would I need? And I'd need a way to accept a payment, to verify that the payment had gone through, probably to give a receipt to my customer, and to make sure that that money was received. And you think, oh, that's pretty simple. But it turns out that if you're going to do that in a simple way, it's not simple. And this is where sort of the innovation stack happened. And I would say that, you know, we sort of stumbled onto this formula that I've seen repeated throughout history now. But at the time, we didn't really know what we were doing. But I'll just give you an example. Credit card processing involves a fee. So the question is, well, what should Square charge? And the answer was deceptively simple, which we said we were just going to charge a percentage of the transaction. And the problem was, at the time, nobody else in the industry used that same metric. They were always charged a flat fee plus a percentage. And that's just too much math. Like, why would you have to do both? Now, the idea of the flat fee was relevant, you know, 30 years ago when you had to move carbon copies that, you know, cost 10 cents to move, whether or not there was zeros written or, you know, millions of dollars written on them. But these days, nobody moves carbon copies. It's all electronic. So there is no really fixed cost in the credit card system anymore, but there was still a fixed fee. And we thought, well, this is stupid. So we eliminated the fixed fee, which is something you would only do if you were naive. So Jack and I were very naive, but we said, well, this is a better way. So let's just make it better from the start. And it turns out that doing that cost all sorts of problems. Like, we were losing money on certain transactions. It scared away some banking partners. Like, it just caused a ton of problems. And so then we had to either give up having simple pricing, or we had to figure out other ways to solve those other problems. We started building new things that had never existed before. And this was what essentially became Square's innovation stack. So, I mean, you know, the book's called The Innovation Stack, and I'll just sort of save you guys the trouble of having to read it. And basically, invention is not this one or two trick endeavor. It typically involves dozens. And in Square's case, I counted 14 significant things that we were doing that nobody at the time was doing. And if you add all those things up, what it does is it gives you an entirely new business, a business that's not copied from somebody else's business. And that business has a totally different set of rules.
And just to go into that a little bit more. So I know it's called the innovation stack, but you've described it as a series of interlocking inventions, which you kind of talked about there in terms of dozens of inventions coming together. Now, I guess for someone who is inventive, or has that kind of like problem solving skill, a lot of the time someone can come up with an invention that isn't useful. Right.
Oh, yeah. All the time.
All the time. Right. So how do you differentiate between something that's truly useful and something else, which is just invention for invention's sake?
You can avoid that problem with one simple step, and that is focus on the problem and then just apply the following formula. Start by assuming that somebody else has solved it and copy what they did. And then invent as a last resort. And I know I just wrote a book on innovation, and I'm a big proponent of innovation. And I wrote the book specifically to encourage more people to follow that path. but I don't want it to be a false path. In other words, I don't want it to be the sort of, you know, seminar innovation where you go to some, you know, weekend retreat and you come back with some damn fleece jacket that says Patagonia Innovation Summit 2020. And you feel empowered to go invent something. No. The process, at least the process that I've always seen succeed, is a very painful recognition of sort of the end of mankind's knowledge. Like, innovation starts where we run out of knowledge. So you're trying to solve a problem. You discover that nobody else has figured this out. So now you have to figure it out by yourself. And that's probably not going to be a very pleasant process. It's probably not going to be something where you say, oh, I got a cool gizmo that's going to fix it. You just have to slug it out. And you'll probably have to do not one thing or two things. You'll probably have to do 10 things before the problem is truly solved. But in doing so, you will have begun an innovation stack. And now you have, at least in the world of business, probably one of the most powerful things you can possibly have. And something that will protect you from massive competitors, and something that, if you play it right, can lock up a market for generations.
You talked about the florist that was outside Jack's apartment or something like that. That was probably your first customer or first user. Like, how did you get your first 10 or 100 customers? Do you remember that far back?
Yeah, so it was really funny. We would just show the product to people, and they would want to use it. And that was really strange, because our initial product was only useful if you were selling something. And most people don't sell things. So we figured out that, you know, if we found 10 people at random, only one of them was actually likely to be selling anything. But even then, we would show the product, and almost everybody knew somebody who needed it. So if we'd show the product, I'd say, I've showed it to you. Well, maybe you're not in the business of selling anything, but maybe your sister, you know, has a quilt business and she's, you know, going to craft fairs. She's like, oh, this would be perfect. So we didn't do any promotion. We didn't do any advertising. And we just showed the world the product and they bought it.
Like, showing people, like, was that literally you guys going out on the street? Did you have people, like, staff who were going out to these markets and fairs? I'm just curious, like, what that looks like in practice.
No, it was even simpler than that. We just announced the product, a 99 character tweet. Jack sent out a little tweet saying, we have a product. This was once we were out of beta test, but, even before that, the beta testing period, it was super simple. I would show the product, or Jack would show the product to somebody, and they would always know somebody who wanted it. And we'd say, oh, okay, well, they can sign up. And they'd sign up. And then, you know, as soon as they'd use it, they'd meet 20 people who wanted the product, and they'd all call us. So we had no trouble getting customers.
Got you. That makes sense. Yeah, I forgot by that point, you guys already had some established following as well, which probably helps in initial stages and to get those initial customers as well, I guess.
So there are two phases of the launch. There was the beta launch, and that was when, remember, so Square had a piece of hardware. I had to build each one of those by hand.
Yeah.
So the limiting factor in the early Square days was how quickly I could use a Bridgeport mill and hand assemble a reader. Cause I mean, it took me probably an hour to build each one. You know, I had my wife working. I had, you know, my friends work. I you know, this sort of crazy labor force building these things. But we were all constrained by how many pieces of hardware I could get out the door, because, you know, the software was no problem. And the other problem with the beta test was that a lot of it was illegal. like a lot of the stuff that we were doing in the early days was not compliant with the banks. Or the feds or the credit cards or God, I mean, there were a bunch of people. We counted at one point 17 laws and rules that we were violating with each transaction. So before we released it publicly, we had to get compliant.
This seems like there was this almost like unlimited demand. As soon as people saw it, they were like, oh, I need that. Right. But like, what were the big players missing in this play? Like this, your company's become a multi-billion dollar company by this point. So like, what were those existing players ignoring And why do you think they were ignoring it? Do you think it was just because it was an underserved market, or was the bottom of the market, as you described?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. And this is the power of not copying. So the market before Square entered it was a very established market. It had been around for 40 years. All the niches were filled, and the market ended at about $100,000. In other words, if you sold less than $100,000, you almost certainly didn't accept credit cards because it was too expensive. The equipment was, you know, thousands of dollars. The contracts were 3 years, and small merchants, which we'll define as anyone selling less than 100 grand, just weren't included. And the market had built systems and policies and laws to essentially preserve what it thought was the whole market. And it turns out it ignored all of the small merchants who would have happily taken credit cards if it had been just a little more accessible. And so Square very naively built outside the market. So we didn't use traditional underwriting. We didn't use traditional software. We didn't use traditional receipts or contracts or sign-up periods or customer support. Like we did all these things differently. And as a result, we built something that worked for people who would not in that market. So now let's take the example of a competitor who wants to compete with Square, and a lot of them did. So Verifone, which was one of the larger players in the market, their CEO took me out to dinner one night. He called me an idiot for about an hour. And then he told me how stupid I was to try to serve the little people, because he said, you know, they're deadbeats and they're not trustworthy. And if they steal your money, you can't sue them because they're too small. So you're going to get killed. And, you know, he was running a $4 billion company, and I was a guy who, you know, didn't know anything about credit cards. So I kind of had to listen to him. But his perspective, I think, was correct in one sense. And that is, from where he stood, using the rules that he understood and the market forces and prices that he had lived with for a decade, yeah, what I was doing was impossible. What he didn't understand was that I wasn't using any of his tools. I had a totally different set of tools. I was building using all this different technology. And it's almost like, you know, quantum computing is not something you can compare to normal computing. Like, I don't even understand quantum computing all that well, but at least the stuff that I've seen with quantum computing, like, you just can't approach it, you know, like a normal Turing machine, like a normal programmer would. So if you're in this world and you're playing against somebody who has a totally different set of physics, they may be able to do something that you think is impossible. And for you, it is impossible, but for them, it's not.
And I'd love to go into that a little bit more detail. Like, what were the specifics that radically reduced the price? Of course, you guys can say this is going to be free or this is going to be a cheaper price in the market. But for you guys to be able to serve that, you also have to, as you said, innovate and bring down the cost. So it was
Square's innovation stack. It was 14 different things, and none of them can be removed. So you tick any one of them. Like, we had hardware. Okay, so we needed to give our customers hardware so they could read the card, because they needed to read a magstripe, and the iPhone won't read a magstripe. So we need to give them a reader. And at the time, a credit card reader on the market sold for about $1,000. That's what they retailed.
Oh, God. Okay.
Okay. So I built one that cost 97 cents to manufacture.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Like, we could have sold it for $100 and been, you know, 10% of the price. We could have sold it for $10 and been 1% of the price. We could have sold it for $1 and been 1,000th of the price. And $1 was pretty much our cost. So we were like, oh, that's so cheap, we'll just give it away. So, like, our hardware was free. Okay. So let's start with that. But, you know, our hardware had to plug into the iPhone, and we had to sort of hack the iPhone to make it work. So there was some innovation there. Then we had to set up a way to have a paperless experience, which at the time was impossible because of all the rules in the credit card world, required signed contracts. And you can't just take one of these things and separate it from the rest and say, oh, this is what made Square possible. And it was funny, you know, because I was talking when I was writing the book, I was talking to Herb Kelleher, founder of Southwest, and he said every airline that tried to copy Southwest Airlines, and there were dozens, they all failed because they tried to copy two or three of the things that Southwest was doing, and Southwest was doing 15 different things. Southwest innovation stack was 15 different elements, and you would copy three of them and then open your airline and wonder why it didn't work. And in Square's case, if you tried to do what we were doing, but you had paper-based contracts, well, then you couldn't do it. But if you wanted electronic contracts, then you had to have different underwriting. So you had to build different underwriting, which meant different relationships with the bank, which means you had to have a different customer support, which means you had to have different financing. And now you have to tie that back into how your software is going to perform and how your hardware is going to tie to the software. And like, it's all this stuff. So you split out one.
I'm glad you went into that, because just that 1,000x decrease in cost already kind of demonstrates that's just one of, I think, 11 you said. So if you multiply all of those other innovations, it drastically brings down the cost already, and probably the experience as well.
So Bilal, for your reader or for your listeners, let's do another exercise. Okay. Let's take the 1,000x hardware advantage and think like a traditional business. Okay. So I'm going to hand over my invention to this guy who runs a traditional credit card company. And I'm going to say, here is a cheap credit card reader. Basically costs a buck as opposed to the $1,000 that is normal in the industry. You know what he's going to do? He's going to say, oh, cool. Well, if my cost is a dollar and my competitor's selling at $1,000, I'm going to sell this for $500.
Yeah.
I'll be half the price of my competitors, and I'm going to make $500 on every sale. And then as soon as he starts doing this, his competitors are going to look at that little device and say, oh, well, we could build that thing. So they're going to copy them. So their cost is now, you know, pretty close to a dollar. So now they're going to start competing with each other, and one of them will charge 400 and another one will charge 300. And then, you know, they'll probably settle around $100. They're going to ignore everything else that we did. And you're going to have this little incremental improvement in the credit card market, but nothing that changes the world.
And I guess we're going to come into some other examples a little bit later, but that really demonstrates like just one piece on its own isn't going to be enough. Like you need the other pieces. And to me, it really comes from the attitude as well, because if you're used to doing things in a certain way, and now you can make, you know, 50% or 1,000% more margin or whatever it ends up being, that's probably where people incrementally go. But if you're actually coming at it with fresh eyes and you're saying, no, this needs to be 1,000 times cheaper for us to be able to give it away basically for free, then it creates a whole different problem statement essentially.
Yeah. And like, I've got to sort of underline this, and that is the reason I wrote the book, okay, is to get people to recognize those moments when innovation is necessary and what innovation actually looks like. Because we have this massive delusion about what innovation is. And it's holding so many people back. And I'll give you an example of the person that I wrote the book for. So when I was writing the book, I had this one person in mind, and she's really competent. And she's got everything. She's beautiful. She's brilliant. She's hardworking. She's got phenomenal degrees from institutions that you would recognize if I gave you their names. And just like qualified in every level. And yet this person, whenever she encounters a problem where there is not a solution already in existence, she says, well, I can't do that. Now, this breaks my heart, because I see this person and I know she could do some amazing stuff, but she always stops herself because her whole life she has been trained to not do something until she becomes qualified. So now that's really good behavior. That's really good behavior for most situations. But what happens when you run up against the problem that hasn't been solved? And you say, well, I'm not qualified to do this because I've never done it before. I have to get trained by somebody who's already solved this problem. Oh, wait, nobody has solved this problem. You can't get trained by anybody. You can't get certified. You can't get a diploma or some credential to do something that humanity has never done before. So we have this person who has the capacity to do this amazing stuff sitting on the sidelines. Whenever she comes up against the edge of, you know, what mankind has done, she stops. And she stops because she doesn't feel worthy. She says, well, I can't do that. I'm not qualified. And my answer to her, which is, you know, 300 pages of book now, but my answer to her is, no, wait a second. The first person to do anything is always unqualified. So like, I'm a pilot, I fly planes, but you know what? I'm a qualified pilot. I get trained, I get drug tested, I have to take flight reviews, I have to go up, you know, and I have to prove every 2 years that I'm still a good pilot. And I've got to take a medical every 6 months because that's the rules. And if I don't pass one of those checks, then I'm not qualified and I don't get in a plane. But the Wright brothers, who flew the first airplane, well, you can't say neither one of them were qualified because, like,
one was flying nobody ever flown before a plane that.
Before. Yeah. You can't be qualified. The first time something is done, it is always done by an unqualified person.
So one of the things I've heard, I think Peter Thiel actually talked about how Square went up against Amazon and won. And most people can't really say they did that. So I'd love to hear your take about how you guys compete with Amazon, because Amazon, the big bully, if you want to call them that, came in and tried to compete in the same space. And you guys had a unique approach. I'd love to hear how you guys thought about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Peter's talked to me about that a couple times. Here's the thing. When we were 4 years old, still a startup, Amazon copied our product and then they undercut our price by 30%. And when Amazon does this to any startup, the startup dies. In our case, we didn't die. As a matter of fact, a year later, Amazon relented and they were actually really cool about the way they did it. They mailed a Square reader to all their soon to be former customers. So, but I was happy we won, but I couldn't answer the question why. And that was driving me crazy. And so I couldn't find any other companies that had survived Amazon. But what I did do by looking throughout history was I found companies who had been in Square's situation, which is basically startups who are attacked by incumbents. You would expect the incumbent to win, but then the startup wins. And I noticed this weird pattern. Not only did the startups win, but they actually ended up dominating the whole market. So I was like, well, this is really interesting. But then I thought, well, maybe I'm confusing myself, because when you study history, there's this thing called selection bias, where you just choose examples that support your thesis. And since all the people I was studying were basically long since dead, I couldn't ask them if this was their experience. And so I thought, well, maybe I have something, maybe I don't. I need to find somebody who's still alive who's done this. So I thought Southwest Airlines was a good example. And Herb Kelleher, the founder of Southwest, was still alive back then. So I called up Herb and he invited me out to Dallas. And I spent an afternoon with Herb in Dallas. And I showed him all my research. And I said, Herb, I think what we did at Square is similar to what you did starting Southwest Airlines. And yet I can't prove it without your approval. And so Herb looked at it and he got really excited. And he's like, Jim, he's like, a lot of what you're explaining, it fits with Southwest. It's just, you know, we were in the airline industry and you were there. So we had a phenomenal conversation. At the end of the conversation, he said, you need to go and write a book. Like, you need to go tell the world about this, because this is exciting stuff. And so, I mean, you don't understand. Herb Kelleher was my business idol. He was like the big brother that I never had growing up. He was the coolest guy in the world. He had tattoos before they were cool. He smoked. He started his own airline. He had a great sense of humor. I mean, he was chairman of the Dallas Fed. Like, he was just a total badass. All right. And when a person like that tells you to do something, you go do it. So Herb basically said, go write a book. Right. So I went off, spent a year, but I didn't want to write an actual book, because I thought, no, this is too good for a book. I need to write a graphic novel. because the stories are all, you know, there's murders and Nazis and evil gangs and, you know, cities exploding. Like, this is like real stories, these companies. I was like, this is a graphic novel. So I spent a year basically writing a graphic novel about the innovation stack and showed it to Herb, and he hated it. He was like, what are you doing? He's like, you've got this really serious topic and you're treating it like a cartoon. He's like, I don't want to be part of this. And I was like, well, you have to be part of this. I can't write this, you know, and leave my idol out. So I rewrote it as a business book, but it kind of reads like a graphic novel. Even
I think we're going to need to get that version out too, man.
Sure, I did. So if you go to jimmckelvey.com, I did keep some of the graphic novel and you can just download it for free.
Oh, cool.
So just go to jimmckelvey.com. Well, you can pick up, I think it's called The Birth of Banking, about the world's most badass banker. But don't worry, there's a murder. There's a murder, you know.
Like every great story, yeah.
There's a lot of death and destruction and explosions and, yeah, stuff goes wrong. But the point is, coming from this place of real bewilderment and curiosity to explain how a startup can survive an attack by Amazon, I stumbled upon this pattern that made these companies ultra successful. And then I asked myself the question, well, why the hell hasn't anybody else written this? Like, why is this new information? And I never assume it's new. I was like, oh, somebody else must have done this. But then I discovered that there's no word in the English language for somebody who does a business that hasn't been done before. That word does not exist.
And I think your take is that word should be entrepreneur. I've heard you discuss the difference between entrepreneur and a business owner.
So today the word entrepreneur is synonymous with business owner. You start a business, we call you an entrepreneur. Okay. But it's very likely that you're starting a business that has already been done sometime in human history, right? So my friend opens a coffee shop and he's an entrepreneur. Well, I would say yes, today he is considered an entrepreneur because that's how we use the term. Somebody who opens a business is an entrepreneur. But 100 years ago, that was not how the word originated. The word entrepreneur was used to differentiate business people who were doing something totally new, like the Wright brothers, from business people doing normal business, right? So you've opened up a restaurant. I'm not saying that's easy. As a matter of fact, opening up a restaurant is super hard work. Especially these days, but you're not an entrepreneur in the traditional sense. You're a business person. You're somebody who's opened a business. And because we don't have a word anymore, the concepts in my book just couldn't be discussed. And I think that's the reason nobody's ever talked about this stuff is because, and I apologize to the reader, like if you read my book, you're going to have to live through like the first couple paragraphs. I have to like define new terms because we just don't have them in the English language to describe the phenomenon that I need to discuss.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree. There's a difference between what like an Elon Musk is doing, trying to take people to space, or even what you guys did, completely doing something new versus, you know, starting something that's already been done. Just for the sake of time, we might switch gears a little bit. I do want to just capture one part of the journey with Square, which is, you know, this is something a lot of people ask me to ask you when I ask the audience or people on social media. At some point, you become a quote-unquote billionaire, right? According to Forbes and the market cap of the company anyway. Is that something you actually tangibly remember? Like a time where you were like, oh, wow, this is actually, you know, by then you were obviously a very wealthy person, but I'm just curious, like, was that an actual moment that you actually registered?
No, it wasn't. So I don't look at the stock price because it drives me crazy.
Yeah.
And I just don't want to know. The day I actually knew that I was a billionaire, my wife got me a little billfold. I wish I had it on me, but I don't. I'd show it to the camera, but it was this little billfold and it had three little gold commas on it. And she just handed it to me. She's like, I looked up the stock price today and you get this. And she gave me this billfold with a three commas. He enchanted to me upside down. So three commas upside down looks like 666, which, you know, which is also the number of the beast, right? So I thought she was like, I married the devil. But I misinterpreted it. And, you know, somebody told me that I fell off the list this year because stock price was down. And then I think the stock price is up now. I try not to look. I mean, because it doesn't matter. Like, I live a very simple.
Yeah.
Well, no, I don't. And actually, that's not true. I don't live a very simple life. But I don't have the ego to spend the money that I've got. I just don't. I mean, look at this. This is a cheap ass sweater. This is a free, like, I'm wearing a free t-shirt.
You got the swag tee on?
it's like free. Like, almost every day when you see me, I've got some piece of clothing that was either a hand-me-down from somebody who was like, I still had to take clothes from my friends who were throwing it out, or free. Like, I'm just a slob and I don't care. I guess I could find new stuff. Doesn't matter. The weird thing about getting the money to me was not the money. It was how people now treat me as like a walking wallet.
Mm.
Probably 70% of the interactions that I have with people who are not old friends are because I represent this potential donor or investor or some sort of sucker who's going to, you know, fund their thing. And that just sucks.
Yeah. How does that feel, man? Because I mean, you go from having authentic old friends, you know, people that have known you forever when you were an artist doing all this different stuff. Like, people don't really get to talk about this. So I'm curious, like, how do you deal with that?
I try to ignore it. I try to avoid new, environments where I'm going to get hit up. I don't go to things where I'm a source of funding. Like, I try to not be that. So I spend a lot of time hanging out with artists. Believe me, in the glass studio, nobody cares because I'm just another guy with, you know, grimy hands and, you know, burn marks on his jeans. I spend a lot of time with folks who at Launch Code, it's a nonprofit I started. They don't care. I spend a lot of time just away from folks and environments where that matters. Which sucks because a lot of times, you know, I like to be invited to some of those things, but if I'm not coming for my ideas, I really don't want to participate.
I'm also curious, since we're talking about that, we're in 2020, just before an election. Don't worry, I'm not going to talk about politics, but there is a sentiment, kind of an anti-billionaire sentiment that I've felt. I live in New York. I have like friends on social media posting things like billionaires should not exist. You know, and these are people who I know, some of them work in big corporations, work for billionaires, and others work for nonprofits funded by a billionaire. So I'm just curious, like, have you seen that?
I don't completely disagree with it, honestly. I do like first generation money. I do like people who've made it themselves because they tend to be very irresponsible with it. And when I say irresponsible, I mean Elon Musk starting SpaceX. Okay, so he made a bunch of money on PayPal, and then he decides he wants to start a space exploration company. Well, that's crazy, okay? And then he decides he wants to build electric cars back before electric cars were viable, and that's crazy. And so I look at these situations where people who've earned the money themselves do amazing things with it. Now, I might say that the billionaires that I know are all people who've made it from building things. So they're builders. I don't know a lot of financial billionaires. I know you can make a lot of money just, you know, shoving money around. But at least for the people who make a ton of money building stuff, that usually gives them great resources to build a lot of cool stuff. So I'm not sort of against that, but maybe that's just me sort of being self-serving because that's the category I hope that I'm in.
Yeah, for sure. No, I thought it was worth asking.
You don't have to hate me.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I live in St. Louis. I got a two-car garage and a...
No, I thought it was worth asking because just to give my quick perspective on it is just because... you know, like I respect entrepreneurship a lot. Clearly, this is the basis of the show. I'm not really anti-billionaires, but I get the sentiment. I get where people are coming from. But I think, like everything, it's not a black and white issue. It's, you know, there's a lot of nuance within, like you said, different behavior within different groups. So like within the billionaire class, there's people who do great things with it. There's people who made money really, you know, through innovating and creating things like you said, or people that might have done some shady stuff or exploiting workers, as some people might argue as well. So I think there's nuance, but I thought it was worth asking you because it's not every day I get to ask that question.
Well, I mean, it's an honest question, and I'm sorry to have to be able to answer it. You know?
Yeah. No,
it's an awkward position. It's an awkward position for me.
Yeah. Just,
I never planned on it.
well, great. No, thanks for sharing that. Just for the sake of time, I do want to capture a couple things around the concepts in the book. I think we already discussed quite a lot in the square examples, but we've already kind of defined what the innovation stack is. We talked about the underserved market approach, but I'd love to like look at industries like maybe healthcare, maybe education are two that stand out to me. But are there any others that you would say are really ripe for this sort of innovation? And how would you approach it if you were someone listening trying to attack that market?
Well, I can give you an example in education, which is sort of the family business, because my father, who died last year, but he was an educator his whole life. And I grew up basically in a university setting with my dad, being a professor. And so I deeply respect higher education. That said, when I started my first nonprofit, it was to train people for free. Because I saw what was possible, and a lot of people can't afford $50,000 a year. As a matter of fact, most people can't afford $50,000 a year to go to a fancy school like Washington U. So I opened a free coding school called Launch Code, but it's not really a school. It's really a job placement system that allows you to get a free education, and then we get you a job, and it's open to everybody. So you go to launchcode.org. And if you live in one of the cities where we have a center, you can come in, we'll teach you a set of skills, and then we'll get you a job. And there's no charity here. This is a way to, get more programmers, because the world needs more programmers. And it's actually been a pretty good educational hack. Now, I'm not saying that works for everything. I'm not saying that, everyone can go to these coding camps, but it worked great in programming. And we've gotten, well over 1,000 people, good jobs. So I think there's a lot of room for innovation in education. I think we're going to see a lot of it because of the pandemic. I think forcing schools to go online is going to sort of weed out a lot of the inefficiencies. It's also going to close a lot of colleges.
Yeah. Cool. What about healthcare? Because, I'm a European living in the States, and for me, that's a big change. I'm not saying it's all bad, but of course, just to share for my European friends listening, I pay like $650 a month out of pocket as a self-employed person for healthcare. And that basically means I still pay out of pocket up to like 8,000 a year or something. And to someone listening to this from Europe, they're like, what are you talking about? That's my rent in some places, right? So I feel like when you just talked about problems before, to me, looking at the way things work here, and again, not saying it's all bad, but like, how would you approach thinking about coming up with an innovation stack in that sort of world?
So I think you're seeing some innovation naturally. I think some of the urgent care clinics are pretty cool. Look, healthcare's just a giant mess because, on one hand, you want qualifications, you want safety, you want efficacy standards. Like you wouldn't want a boot camp for doctors. Like if I opened up, sort of Launch Code for surgeons, where I taught you how to, remove an appendix in 6 months, you probably wouldn't want to have those people doing surgeries on you. So it's a different dynamic. What I would say this though, as somebody who's trained in economics, there's a fundamental problem with healthcare in the United States, And that is the people who pay, which are typically the insurance companies, are not the people who get the services. But one of the big problems is that the paying system is that there's no feedback. So the people who consume the healthcare, which is are different than the people who pay for it. So you consume it, but your insurance company pays for it. So it's got a lot of buffet problems, which is to say that, you know, we all tend to eat too much food and the wrong food when we're at the buffet. There's also a real problem with private insurance. So if I ever had an idea on how to fix it, I would jump into it. But right now it's well beyond my abilities to understand.
Great. So we're going to switch gears a little bit now. Thanks so much for sharing your story with Square and the lessons learned and the innovation stack. As a reminder to people, if you're interested in the book, we're actually giving out 5 copies. The details are in the description below, so you can click through the link there and we'll be sharing more out. So we're going to get into the last section now to close things out. And this is kind of the behind the mind section where we discuss different topics. And some of these have come from the audience, people listening. So I know you're also working on the Fed and there's some stuff there. So let me know if there's some things you can't discuss, but we'll try to at least give your opinion, even if it's not an official opinion. So what we kind of touched on the future of payments earlier around global, how that might look globally. But the question really is around cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. I know you guys introduced Bitcoin trading and buying and selling in the Square, in the Cash App. But I've heard you say that you and Jack Dorsey have very different opinions on this, or you have some differing opinions. So I'm curious, like, what yours is versus his and how you guys came to the decision to include that in the Cash App.
Well, Jack's CEO and I'm not, so it's his decision.
Okay.
That's easy. And I do share a lot of Jack's thoughts on crypto. I have one thing that I'm concerned with, and that is I am worried that anonymous payment can be a vector for crime. And if you look at the examples of criminal behavior, a lot of them are moving to untraceable crypto payments these days. And I think that's going to be a problem for society if we move too fast to enable truly anonymous exchange of value. And my guess is that the governments are going to step in and regulate this, and that people are not going to like the way that happens.
Yeah. And what about, have you probably seen what's going on in China, and like they've got this Chinese digit yuan? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but do you know much about that? And do you have an opinion on that world?
Yeah. So I think China is probably the most innovative country in the world when it comes to payments. And it's basically because they've got two competing mega companies that have, you know, 43% and 48% of the market respectively. If you look at Alibaba and Tencent and the fights that are going on there, it's this perfect example of, you know, competitiveness, because you've got two innovative companies rapidly copying each other and innovating on their own. And then you've got a government that sort of semi-controls both companies because of the way their system is set up. So they're able to, you know, sort of rein in the problems if they need to, in a way that we couldn't do here in the United States, but things are progressing really, really fast. So I loved China as a way of sort of learning about what's possible in payments. I wouldn't say that we should necessarily copy them because we're not that society, but it's fascinating to study.
Another question I had was around investing. Again, it's not every day I get to speak to someone who's created that much wealth within one company and been an entrepreneur for so long. So I'm curious, if you had a 25-year-old son or daughter, which I don't know if you have kids, like what would your advice be to them for investing in the future?
So I would say don't invest in stuff you don't understand. Mm-hmm. And I would say also that investing by itself is probably uninteresting. At least it's been uninteresting to me. I know there are people who do it full time. To me, investing is like real estate. like I dabble in it. I've bought some properties and sold some properties and stuff like that, but I don't do it full time. I don't find it interesting. So I'm not a very good investor, except in areas where I'm a great investor, you know? So I try to stay away from most of it. I say no to almost everything, but if it happens to be in an area where I recognize a pattern, like I see an innovation stack, I'll put all my money into a company like that. Like if I see an innovation stack, I just double down hard. That's worked out actually really well. For the rest of it, I just stay away.
And so if your kids, because your position is a little bit different to maybe not your kids, let's say a 25-year-old, is, you know, because your kids have a rich dad, but like if you have, you know, a regular person.
They're not going to be rich kids.
Yeah. And I'd love to talk about it actually as well, because okay. So maybe it will be for your kids. Like, I guess if they were earning a regular salary, like, is there certain lessons that you would teach them around that? Like, what would they tangibly invest in that might be different to what you're investing now with your own money?
Well, it's the same thing. But the critical thing with my kids is I don't know if they want to be rich or not. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, I came into a lot of money late, and I didn't really want it. I did not want it, but turns out I didn't want it as badly as I thought I'd be buying more stuff or doing more stuff, and I'm not. Oh, well, who knows? You know, I thought maybe I'd be that guy tooling around in a Ferrari. I got one car, it's 20 years old. Can't sell it. Thing still starts. Like, why would I sell it? You know, it's the same Acura that I had when I was working with Jack 25 years ago. Like, it's the same damn car.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just me. But in the case of my kids, what I thought is this, is like, look, if they want to be rich, I can probably help them do that. Like if somebody wants to be rich, I can probably give them a bunch of tricks. But being rich is a choice. And by the way, if you inherit money, you're not rich.
Mm.
For the following reason, if you inherit money, at least the money that I've seen, it comes with this a little bit of guilt because you didn't earn it yourself. And look at a guy like Elon Musk and all the crazy stuff he's done, you know, with Tesla and SpaceX and people calling him crazy for years. And he could do that because it was his money. It wasn't his grandpa's money. And he decides he wants to land a rocket standing up. He could do that, right? It's his damn money. You know, just like me, I piss my money away on all sorts of stupid stuff. You know, like I'm trying to do a bunch of projects right now. People are like, well, that'll never work. And I'm like, yeah, but it's my money. I earned it. I can blow it, you know? And I think that's sort of appropriate. And I think that's sort of rich. Is if you feel empowered to do something that everyone else is saying is stupid. So I've been, I've been super lucky, but I don't want to force my kids to live a life of inherited wealth if that's not what they want. So they're going to start off with a good education and maybe some advice from their old man if they want it.
Okay. I love that, man. Yeah, for sure. And actually you kind of touched on that. So I've heard you talk about being kind of against generational wealth transfer. And you kind of touched on it there saying those people that inherit that money often live worse lives. They obviously they're still privileged and they have, they don't have money problems like most people do, but that doesn't mean they're not.
Here's the thing about inherited wealth. Okay. I grew up with rich people around me and most of them are very unhappy. And I'm sorry to say that, but it comes with a certain swagger that's not there. Like if you make it yourself, you can do whatever the hell you want. If it's coming from daddy or from grandpa or from your great aunt, it's got strings attached and those strings sort of bind these people. And I feel sorry for a lot of my rich friends who they're stuck with all this money. But by the way, it's not even their money because they're sort of expected to pass it on to their grandchildren, right? Or their, you know, so it becomes this burden and it just sucks. I feel bad for some of these people.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. Yeah, I've always liked the differentiation between different types of problems and, you know, money doesn't solve all problems. It just solves money problems. And that means paying your rent and not being in credit card debt and not having student loan debt and the kind of stresses that a lot of people have. But the more, you know, wealthy people I speak to, the more it reiterates what we always hear, which is obviously that doesn't equal happiness. Often it creates more problems as well in other ways. So, I think it was worth asking. And I guess that kind of transitions into something I know you care a lot about, which is philanthropy. And you talked about your coding non-profit before. Like, I'd love to hear your kind of take on how you approach philanthropy and maybe how that's changed over the years as well.
So there's a problem with my philanthropy, and that is I'm still earning money. So a lot of the stuff I do still makes money. And so I'm not really done earning money yet, even though I don't need to. A lot of the activities I do are still sort of businessy activities, and they're probably going to pile up more before I'm done. So I'm approaching philanthropy very carefully because I think it's important, but I don't understand it yet. So I'm just a student. I'm just learning, and I'm trying a few donations and seeing how they work. But I'm also trying to just be humble and learn.
No, I got you. Yeah. And are there certain sectors or, you know, even in your early learning in philanthropy, are there parts of it that you're like, oh, I really care about education, like you said, or, you know, there's so many causes out there, of course, and you can't help them all. So it feels like someone like you thinks about effective ways of doing things. So I don't know if you've even got to that stage yet.
So the only philanthropic investments that I make right now are ones where they need an idiot. Okay.
Yeah.
Where they need somebody who, if it wasn't for this idiot, the thing wouldn't exist. So I gave a bunch of money to a cancer company that's got a really promising treatment for cancer. They couldn't get any funding. I don't understand life science very well, but I looked at the research and I was like, well, either these guys are lying to me or there's something here that might save a bunch of lives. And nobody else would fund them, so I funded them. We're now 4 years later in a stage 3 trial in Switzerland, so it might actually work, right? But if it wasn't for this idiot, they'd be out of business, you know? And they needed an idiot, and I was that idiot because I earned it, I could piss it away. A couple months ago, I gave a lot of money to WashU's med school because we need a coronavirus vaccine. We need testing, and the government wasn't getting the money out fast enough. And even though I know the government was eventually going to fund this, like, every day we're losing 1,000 people in this country who are dying because we don't have a vaccine. And if I can accelerate even, you know, a vaccine discovery by a week, that's, you know, that's almost 10,000 people, you know? So I just wrote them a check like the next morning. They had the money. When I invest, right, when I give money away right now, it's because they need somebody who earned it themselves and can piss it away and be an idiot. So I'm sort of the idiot.
Love it. Love that. Thanks, man. Just a couple of things to round us off, because I know we need to go in a couple of minutes. This is a question that I used to ask a lot, and I haven't in recent times, but given the current situation, and a few people asked this when I asked the audience what I should ask you, they wanted to know kind of like one of your worst times.
Well, it was after my mom died. My mom committed suicide, and she died before I'd ever done anything, you know, significant, really. And I fell into a depression, and I stayed in a depression for the better part of a year. And then at some point I was like, well, mom would have really been pissed off to see me sitting around doing nothing. So I got off my ass and did something. And then there was no checklist. I didn't do therapy. Actually, you know what? I didn't do therapy, but I did this one thing that was actually pretty good, and I'll share it with your listeners. I started volunteering at a sheltered workshop. So I don't know if you know what these are. These are places where handicapped people go and work, and they're usually in old schools that are unair conditioned. And St. Louis is really hot, so I used to go and spend my days. You know, every other week I'd go in and just work. Around people who were really handicapped, but man, it was fun. These people, they were wonderful folks. And I remember one day, a girl came up to me and she said, "Hi, Jim." And I didn't know her name. And she had an IQ of about 60. I mean, she couldn't drive. She could kind of walk, but she was not doing well, but she remembered my name and I couldn't remember her. And that was so humbling. And I just thought about all the stuff that I had in my life that was good and how these poor folks were so, I mean, you know, I wouldn't have traded positions with them, but they were happy, you know? And I thought, well, what problems do I have? And every time I'd leave the sheltered workshop, all of my problems would just disappear. I was like, oh, Oh, your mom's dead? Guess what? This guy's an orphan. You know, you know, your car's a piece of crap and you got to pop start it by parking it on a hill, which at the time I did. Like, these people can't drive. They can't even walk. They have to have a guardian. Like, I mean, it's like every problem that I had just shrunk in magnitude. And yeah, so maybe that helped me.
Thanks for sharing that. That's a tough thing for anyone to have their parents pass away, but especially in that way. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, man. Is there a question you wish people asked you that you never really get to talk about? Or maybe another phrase, another way. Is there something you would love to talk about that you never really get to share?
Yeah, I'll give you one really quickly because I got to go in a second. There's a dirty joke in the book. This is a little Easter egg for your listeners. And I'll tell you how it got there. So I was writing the book. I wrote this joke. It was so bad that I immediately erased it. And then I thought, no, wait a second, I'm cheating my editor because editors like catching stuff like that. Like if you're an editor, you want to edit, you want to X stuff out. So I left it in so my editor could catch it. But I didn't know that my editor had basically taken another job. And so he was sort of checked out and he didn't get it. Like I don't even know that he read the thing. But he claims he did, but I told him, I said, look, you missed the joke. And he's like, you have to tell me it's in there where it is. And I was like, no, I don't. You have to find it. You're the editor. And he never did. So the thing made it into publication. And it's really bad. But I realize now that, you know, thousands of people have read the book that it's only about 20% of the people actually get it. Like you have to have sort of a bad mind. And I have a, you know, I have a young son and I think like a 10-year-old sometimes. And so it's that sort of humor. It's in there. If you catch it, send me a note.
Well, if you catch it, comment in the comment below and we'll make
sure to share it with you. Don't out it. If you catch it, keep it to yourself. Okay. Don't ruin people's fun. Don't spoil everybody's fun. Bilal, this was great, man.
Well, listen, man, I know you got to go, but thanks so much for opening up and sharing so much. This was awesome.
Thanks, man. We'll see you soon.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. I'll have an episode for you every week. These are raw, uncut, and actionable conversations with the greatest business minds and creators in the world. So make sure you're subscribed. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or CreatorLab FM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.